come on a journey with a cinephile.
Wake up, sucker. We're thieves and we're bad guys. That's exactly what we are.
We was getting too big for our bitches.
Excellent day for an exorcism.
What have you done to its eyes?
I said, I'm not gonna hurt you. I'm just gonna bash your brains in.
What's your favorite scary movie?
Biddy well, little brother. Biddy well.
Hello and welcome, listeners, to episode 137 of Journey with a Cinephile, a horror movie podcast. As always, I'm your tour guide here of David Garrett Jr., recording out of Columbus, Ohio. And on this episode here for you, I have my Trek to the Twos number 11, as I have featured reviews of The Living Dead. This is from 1932. Kind of an interesting little movie there that is a mashup of Edgar Allan Poe and Robert Louis Stevenson stories. And then I'm pairing that up with the 2022 release of They Live in the Gray. This might have been a 2021 movie. I'm not sure if it did its festival rounds, but I know it's getting its wide release regardless here in this year. So this actually makes for an interesting double feature here of kind of people who don't necessarily enjoy the life they're living and are struggling and trying to just kind of get through things. Makes for an interesting little double feature there. And then I also have mini reviews of Raiga, The Monster from the Deep Sea, Wreck 2, American Werewolves, a documentary screener that I got to watch, Zombie from 1979, The Sixth Sense, and The Last Broadcast, as I'm doing a little bit more of that Summer Challenge Series prep for the podcast Under the Stairs. Don't think there's anything else I need to get you up to speed with here for this episode, so let me get you over to a very brief break before I get you to deliver those mini reviews. I want to thank you for listening first off as well, and I hope you enjoy coming on this journey with me. And for my first mini review here of this week is going to be Raiga, The Monster from the Deep. This went by the original title of Shin Kaiju Raiga, and I also believe there's another title of Deep Sea Monster Raiga. Now, this was written and directed by Shinpei Hayashiya. This stars Ryan Davis, Kazu Igumi, and Manayami Enosawa. This is an action fantasy film, but because this is a kaiju movie, I also throw this into a horror-adjacent type category and kind of just lump these in there like that. But this is from Japan. It is currently sitting on a 5.5 on IMDb and a 2.8 on Letterboxd, with the synopsis being, when the Earth's ecosystem is disrupted due to global warming, a plethora of prehistoric sea monsters wage war on Japan, led by the powerful Raiga. The monsters ravage the city of Asakusa. So this is a movie that I never heard of until I saw it being shown at the Gateway Film Center for their Mammoth Monday series. What shocked me was that when I investigated this, it came out in 2009, and there still are less than 100 ratings on the Internet Movie Database. I did see a voice I respect in the horror community of Mr. Parka also saw this and didn't give it a very high rating, but I did go to see this in the theater. And I also need to give credit here to Donna Nelly, is that while I was actually just getting ready to record this, he had commented on my picture in a Facebook group and had alerted me that the writer and director, he believed, worked on like Godzilla films and decided to kind of do his own like fan type film just because he loved the genre. And that does make sense with some of the things that we get in this movie. But because this movie is from 2009, I'm not going to go too much into my thoughts. as this could be a potential pick for the Summer Challenge series. But I do want to give credit to the team making this. It feels like they're paying homage to kaiju films of the past. I think that Raiga is a cool monster. I love the look of it and think that it's interesting. This does feel like it has a low budget, though. The acting is over the top. The story feels underdeveloped and the CGI isn't very good. I will give credit, though, to having someone in a suit or at least making it look that way. I wasn't a huge fan here, as this movie just wasn't for me, even though I am a kaiju fan. So like I said, I'm not going to give my rating here just because this came out in 2009, and that is one of the years that I have. But I would say that, from what Don was telling me, if you like kaiju films, I think you might have a little bit more fun with this. I personally did it, but I'm not really into ones that are a little bit more CGI heavy. So that's where I'm going to leave my thoughts here on Raiga, the monster from the deep sea. And then for my second mini review for you, I have Wreck 2. This is from 2009 as well. This was co-written and co-directed between Juami Balarrago and Paco Plaza, and Manu Diaz also helped them co-write the screenplay. This stars Jonathan D. Meller, Manuela Velasco, and Oscar Zafra. This is a horror thriller film that is from Spain that is currently sitting on a 6.5 on IMDb and a 3.1 on Letterboxd, with the synopsis being, in order to ascertain the current situation inside, a supposed medical officer and a GEO team step into the quarantine and ill-fated apartment building. So this is a movie that I was late to see in the original, and it's now a series that intrigues me. When it appeared in the Summer Challenge series for the podcast Under the Stairs, I knew I had a reason to finally move it up my list. It also fulfilled requirements for an October movie challenge that I was working on at that time. And I should also point out that I did a mini review back on episode number 49, which was Journey Through the Aughts number 22, which the two featured reviews were The Flesh and the Fiends and Possessor Uncut. So it's been a little bit since that last time I watched it, and once again, I'm going to go very light, because if you want to hear more, I would direct you over to that episode for a little bit more in-depth review. And then this is also a potential pick for the Summer Challenge series on the podcast Under the Stairs. So I think this is a good follow-up to that earlier film. Something that works for me is that it flows right into this one and builds around the story we got to continue it on. This movie leans into the more religious aspects earlier, and this is one of my favorite subgenres, so I don't mind that. It isn't as impactful, though. I think the acting works for a found footage movie, and it makes sense as to why things we see are being filmed. Effects work for me overall, as there isn't much in the way of a soundtrack either, but that does add to the realism in my opinion. I would say that this does some creepy things with possessed people's voices, which adds another element to this overall. I do know there's a little bit of CGI that I did have some slight issues with, but it doesn't linger on it too much, and there's not a lot of it, so I can be forgiving there. But I do think this is a worthy sequel, and I think this is a good movie. I'm not going to give my rating here, but if you like Wreck, I would highly recommend watching this follow-up, as it almost feels like one long movie if you kind of do them back-to-back from what I've been told. And then up next for you, I have a documentary that I got sent to me over as a screener. Now, there wasn't an IMDb page at this time, but it is American Werewolves that was written and directed by Seth Breedlove. This is from 2022. And the synopsis here is going to be, each year, dozens of encounters with upright canids are reported in North America. These beings often behave in similar ways, with many reports recounting a creature that is aggressive, ghastly, and disturbing. While many theorize that the dogman is some sort of unidentified species of animal, many believe that what they were confronted by was something else and something more. So this is another documentary that was sent over to me by Justin Cook, and I got to watch it ahead of its release. I've seen five of these docs that cover different cryptids from Breedlove. I like the route that this takes with these, so I was intrigued to check this one out, and I also have to shout out his company of Small Town Monsters. So for this documentary, we are getting something a bit different than some of the other ones that I've seen. This one mostly focused on interviewing different people who have come in contact with what they believe to be werewolves, dogmen, or a similar creature of sorts. I like that they kicked this off with a disclaimer that there's more than one way to read this information, and that this one isn't pushing you one way or the other. It wants you to take the information and kind of make your own decision. It is taking the people's stories and then just giving them to you. This movie does an interesting job at giving the lore of werewolves. They have a couple of experts on, and they point out that this goes as far back as the Greeks. The term that they use is lycanthropy, which would evolve into lycanthropy. I also didn't realize that were means man, so werewolf is a literal translation to man-wolf. Now, We get stories here from a couple different places. The first groupings are from near where I live, and that town that they're actually going to is Bucyrus, Ohio. It is around here that it seems like werewolf lore is combined with Wendigo mythology. They also go down to Land Between the Lakes, Kentucky. It is here that it seems like werewolf is intermixed with dogman and even Ragaroo myths. I like that Breedlove interviews a cross-section of people. We have hunters, ex-police officers, and just normal people as well. There are also experts mixed in, which gives a different perspective on things. I can appreciate that for a documentary. The only thing I would have liked better if they would have had some detractors. That would cover all angles, in my opinion. Something else I wanted to bring up here would be the filmmaking. How the interviews are shot are good. I can appreciate that Breedlove does things to liven up his documentaries with reenacting what we are hearing. And for this movie, we also get someone in a great werewolf costume. It is creepy with realism, which I enjoyed. Much like the others that I've seen from him, I do think that he knows what he's doing and he makes these documentaries so well. So I would say that if you're interested in werewolves, dogmen, or cryptids and want a documentary about people's encounters with them, I'd recommend this. I personally don't believe in them, but I can't discredit any of the people interviewed here. Don't come in expecting to learn anything necessarily new about the lore. What this is good for is to learn about local urban legends and myths about what I've said above. This is an above average documentary for me, much like the rest of the ones from Breedlove and Small Town Monsters. So my rating here for American Werewolves is going to be a 6.5 out of 10. And this is going to be out, it looks like July 5th, where it'll be available on iTunes, Amazon Prime Video, Vudu, Fandango Now, and coming from 1091 Pictures. And then just to confirm, it'll be on the major streaming platforms on July 5th, which if you don't know, that is my birthday as well. So if you want to get me a birthday present, go ahead and give this one a watch if this sounds interesting to you. And then I also got to watch another movie in prep for the Summer Challenge series of Zombie. This is from 1979. It was directed by Lucio Fulci. It was written by Elisa Briganti, and then uncredited was Dardano Sarchetti. This stars Tisa Farrow, Ian McCullough, and Richard Johnson. This is a horror film that is from Italy. It is currently sitting on a 6.8 on IMDb and a 3.6 on Letterboxd, with the synopsis being, strangers searching for a young woman's missing father arrive at a tropical island where a doctor desperately seeks the cause and cure of a recent epidemic of the undead. So this is a film that I saw for the first time as a kid. My earliest memory is the infamous scene in the movie and being freaked out by it. It is one that I've seen a handful of times throughout the years. I've recently seen this one at the theater at the Gateway Film Center for a spotlight on its director, Fulci. My latest viewing is the 4K in prep for the summer series, as I was saying. So since it could also be on that show, this is one of my favorite zombie movies of all time. I have nostalgia having seen this one growing up, and it still holds up for me. There is a basic story that works. I like what Dr. Menard is doing on this island and how we get the rest of the characters there. Thought the acting was good. The effects were great. There is good cinematography and an amazing score. This is from the 1970s and Italy, so keep that in mind. Some of the dubbing is off, but that comes with its territory. If you're a zombie fan, I think this is one of the best in the genre and would recommend viewing, especially because I think this is a little bit more approachable if you can get past the gore, because they're not really dealing with a whole lot of that nightmare logic. So since I'm not going to give you my rating, that's where I'm going to leave everything here, as I love this movie, if you couldn't tell. And also, I love the European name for it as well, of Zombie Flesh Eaters. And there's also Zombie 2, because Italy wanted to capitalize on the success of Dawn of the Dead, which was zombie over there as well. And I will digress. And then up next for you, I have The Sixth Sense. This is from 1999. This was written and directed by M. Night Shyamalan. This stars Bruce Willis, Haley Joel Osment, and Toni Collette. This is a drama, mystery, thriller, and I also consider this to be a horror movie. This is from the United States. It is currently sitting on an 8.2 on IMDb and a 3.9 on Letterboxd, with the synopsis being, a frightened, withdrawn Philadelphia boy who communicates with spirits seeks the help of a disheartened child psychologist. So this is a movie that I remember coming out, but upon that first viewing that was actually for the Summer Challenge series, I wasn't sure if I had ever watched this movie all the way through. It was one that I would catch at different times, but I don't remember watching it from the start, so I had seen it to an extent. Now, I won't spoil the twist in this one, but I will say that it was spoiled for me ahead of my first time watching it. This is one that I've heard some people say that it loses its impact with subsequent viewings, and I agree with that to an extent. Now, Jamie had never watched this and wanted to check it out, so we had watched it on Friday night while we were, you know, kind of lounging and everything, and I needed to rewatch it for the Summer Challenge series. This is the first time I watched it, I was on the People's Council. Now, this could potentially be a pick once again for this year's show. So since it could be on there, I will say that I would highly recommend this one if you haven't seen it. It's one that really put writer-director Shyamalan on the map. We have a good story, and the twist is amazing. There is also heart in between the characters. It is edited to where it builds necessary tension to the climax. Thought the acting was good across the board. There aren't a lot in the way of effects, but the ones that we get look to be practical and done in a way where it's almost a subtle type way where they're not going over the top with things. Thought the soundtrack fit and was fine for what they needed for it to do. Overall, I'd say this is more of a thriller than horror, but I think it has enough elements to fall in genre. We have ghosts. Our main character of Cole is descending into madness due to him being able to see them, and just a creepy vibe. I would recommend seeing this, and I also think it's a good one and deserves to be viewed if you've never seen it. Now, I know most everybody probably has already had this spoiled from, you know, different things. I had a cousin who told me what it was. I still think that I don't necessarily fall in the camp where it doesn't hold up after subsequent viewings, as I think it's fun to kind of pick things out and to kind of look at what the movie is conveying and to see where characters are looking and to make sense that I think Shyamalan did a really good job at making it where we think one thing that first time through and then the other viewings, it's kind of seeing how well he can, you know, craft different things where I don't necessarily think any of it is a cheat and everything like that. So I'm not going to give my rating, but I do recommend giving this one a watch. And for my last mini review of this week is going to be The Last Broadcast. This is from 1998. This was written and directed amongst Stefan Avalos and Lance Vyler. Now, this stars David Beard, Vyler, and Avalos as well. This is a horror mystery film that is from the United States. It is currently sitting on a 5.3 on IMDb and a 2.6 on Letterboxd, with the synopsis being, a film crew ventures into the forest in search of the mythical Jersey Devil. So, this is a film that I heard about through podcasts. I think it's a bit more independent, so I'm not sure why I never checked this out while I was growing up. This was around the same time that I was expanding my horror viewing outside of things that my parents loved. It is interesting as well since there is a contention that comes with this and the Blair Witch Project having similar styles as well as coming out so close together. So my first viewing was when I was on the People's Council for the podcast Under the Stairs, and I've now rewatched it as a potential pick for the show. So I'm going to go light on my thoughts here, but this film is quite interesting. It's a blend of found footage and mockumentary. I like what they're trying to do here and how events can change the course of all those involved. It's an interesting documentary recapping the events and in the end becomes real. The acting fits what was needed. There's not a lot in the way of effects, but will we get work? I feel like it feels real enough. Despite how low budget this is, there is a sense of realism that comes with it. My first viewing, I had my issues, and I think part of it is that I thought we were going to get kind of like a creature feature, but that's not what we're getting here, but I'm glad I gave this a rewatch. It clicked more after that second viewing, and I appreciate it much more. So I'm not going to give up my rating, but if you like found footage, you really do need to see this movie. Temper your expectations, come in and just kind of gloss over everything that it gives you, and I think it's got an interesting way that things kind of play out here, as this does feel like a true crime documentary. So as I said, I'm not going to give my rating here, but definitely check this one out. And so what I'm going to go ahead and do then is get you over to the trailer of my first featured review. Thank you. And for my first featured review here on this episode is going to be The Living Dead. This is from 1932. It goes by the original title of Unheimlichen Gestalten. Now, this is directed by Richard Oswald, who also helped co-write the screenplay with Heinz Goldberg and Hino Svatsenmaren. And then this is from stories from Edgar Allan Poe, as well as Robert Louis Stevenson. This stars Paul Wegener, Maria Koppenhofer, and Blandine Ebbinger. This also features Eugen Klaufer, Harold Paulson, Roma Bond, Mary Parker, Paul Heckels, Gernard Beinert, John Gottwatt, Erwin Klasser, Franz Stein, Gretel Burnt, Elise Frühsteinberg, Karl-Heinz Charl, Fred Goebel, Natasha Sylvia, and Carl Meinhardt. And if I mispronounce any of your names, I do apologize there. This is a comedy sci-fi horror film that is from Germany. It is currently sitting on a 6.5 on IMDb and a 3.3 on Letterboxd, with our synopsis here being a crazed scientist murders his wife, walls her up, and then flees. A reporter sets out to track him down. So this is a movie that I found thanks to Letterboxd when I was looking for ones from 1932. I didn't know much about this one aside from the title and that it was on YouTube. It wasn't until settling in to make sure that I had the right movie that I saw this was from Germany and starred Wegener. I recognized him as the director and star from 1920's The Golem. So that was about the extent of what I knew. And that's where I'm actually going to go over to and talk about some of the key people here. And I'll start with our director of Oswald. He has 79 works, and this seems to be the first one that I've seen. Five of what he's done is in horror. His first was A Night of Horror from 1917, then Eerie Tales from 1919. Now, I did read up a little bit that this movie seems to be a remake of that one of sorts. Now, he also did Nachtgestalten from 1920 and a take on The Hounds of the Baskervilles from 1929. So, the one from 1920 is a lost film that I brought up a couple years ago when I watched everything that I could find for 1920. As a writer, he has 42 credits, and this is the only one that I've seen. He has four in horror with Eerie Tales, Nachtgestalten, and A Strange Case from 1914. Then working with him as a writer is Goldberg. He has 20 works to his credit. This is the only one in horror that I've seen. Now, this is the only thing that Staatsmari wrote, and that was made into a movie. So since we're using a Stevenson story, I'll bring him up again as he has 117 adaptations of his work. I've seen 16. All are in horror, and there are 39 total. That makes for 13% overall and 41% in genre. Then the last writer is Poe. There have been 124 adaptations of his stories. I've seen 17. 99 of his are in horror, and all the ones that I've seen fall in genre. So I'm at 17% of his horror output and 13% overall. So moving over to our cast, I'll start with Wegener. He has 58 movies. Of them, I've seen two. His most popular was The Golem, or How He Came Into the World from 1920, which he also wrote and directed. Now, that's one I was bringing up earlier that I've actually covered on this show. And that's the only one that I've seen from him, other than this one here. His first was another take on The Golem from 1915. He followed that with The Golem and the Dancing Girl from 1917. He was also in the lost Nachtgestalten, The Magician from 1926, The Strange Case of Captain Ramper from 1928, A Daughter of Destiny from 28 as well. And this was his last in genre. Moving over to Koppenhofer, she has 35 credits. This is the only one that I've seen that's also in horror. Then last, I'll look at Paulson. He has 95 works that he's been in. I've seen two. His most popular was also in horror with Genuine, The Tragedy of a Vampire, which I've covered. And those are the only two horror movies that he has done. So to get into this movie here, we start with a couple in a car. The man driving is Frank Briggs, portrayed by Paulson, and he is a journalist. With him is his fiancée, played by Mary Parker. I believe she's a dancer or something along these lines, and they're on the way to one of her performances. As they're going, Frank hears a scream and he wants to investigate. There's only one house in the area, and it belongs to Wegener. He lives there with his wife, and he's working in his laboratory, and his wife comes in with their cat. An accident happens, destroying his experiment, and he kills her in anger and also hurts the cat. Now, Frank shows up, and Wegener sends him away. He then goes to get the police involved when he learns that Wegener's wife is missing. Now, this man is brash and annoyed when the cops be in there. They make a grisly discovery that causes him to go on the run. Frank is hot on his trail. It leads him to a mental hospital with a dark truth and to a secret society where its members want to commit suicide. So that's going to be cut my recap a little bit short there, as I don't want to spoil things, even though this movie is, you know, 90 plus years old. This is also a difficult one due to the lack of character names for people, as they are also in German. I did take a bit of German in college, so I was able to kind of have translate in my head what some of this stuff was. Regardless, though, I enjoyed this movie. Now, in the opening credits, I saw this was based off of a couple post-short stories, as well as combined elements from Stevenson's The Suicide Club. I had never heard this last one, but I am now intrigued. We are also getting The Black Cat from Poe. Now, it's interesting that we would see Roger Corman do this with posteries or just slapping the names of them onto his movies, but this is what Brian De Palma would do with, like, Body Double or Phantom of the Paradise, and what I'm getting here is kind of take a couple of different stories, mix them together in a blender, and then make your product. So it's kind of a cool thing that The Living Dead is doing this back all the way in 32. But a double bit deeper here, I want to explore the character of Wagner. He is credited as Mordor, which I'm guessing is murderer. This character is diabolical. He's a mad scientist, for one. I'm not sure what the experiment he is working on, but he gets mad at his wife and he snaps. I also like that he's a bit arrogant, which we see with the police when they come to the house. There's also this odd sequence at a mental hospital, which is quite creepy. I've come back to that shortly, though, but it shouldn't be come as a shock, but Wagner's character also runs a secret society. This is where he becomes a Bond villain. Now, I know that Fu Manchu serials and movies were already out, so I'm wondering if that influenced here. Wagner's look and intensity he brings to the role is spot on for me. I just wanted to make sure that was known here as well. And I mean, that's also why he does so well at playing the Gollum, because of that look. Now, there's not a whole lot to the story, but I did want to go over to the more important set pieces. The first is the mental hospital. Wagner goes in and hides when he is fleeing from the police. Frank goes in as well. When he goes upstairs, we see people begging to be let out. The doctors claim that they're all mad. What is terrifying here, though, is the people in these rooms might actually be the doctors and nurses. There's a dinner scene that pulled my attention. It's quite intense. The other one would be the suicide club. I think that from this point, the movie is conveying an anti-suicide message with how things play out. This is a dark subject to deal with, where all these characters who are members are wanting to see if they draw the ace of spades and it's their time to be killed. That's what happened to whoever draws that card. We see that someone want to be picked, while others not so much. This makes you want to see what elements were taken from that Stevenson story, actually. So next I'll take this over to the acting. I've already said my piece on Wagner. I thought that Paulson was solid as the counterpart to him and our hero. He goes through a lot for this story. I will say that while looking at the cast list, I saw that Eugen Klumpfer was Chief Arts, which I took German, as I was saying, and I remember that Arts is doctor, making him the chief one at this hospital. He is creepier with how things play out. I would say that the acting across the board is good, especially for those in the hospital and the club that we go to later on. Then the last thing I'll go over before doing some trivia would be the filmmaking. I'd say that the cinematography is fine. It is early into cinema, so they don't do a whole lot that stood out. I did like the sets from Wagner's house to the mental hospital and then to the secret club later. They were all good. The latter has an interesting setup when it shows how those that draw this card are killed. It is a bit out there, but I commend the movie for trying for what it did. Other than that, the soundtrack was fine for what was needed. So I think there's only one bit of trivia here that I'm going to use, and that is this was one of over 200 titles in a list of independent feature films made available for television by Advanced Television Pictures, announced back in 1942. At the time, television broadcasting was in its infancy, almost totally curtailed by the advent of World War II, and would not continue to develop until 45 to 46. Because of poor documentation, no record has ever been found of its initial television broadcast. I'm actually surprised if this showed in the United States, especially because I know World War I and World War II were, you know, fought against Germany, and this is a German film. I will digress there, though. So then, in conclusion, this movie I had never heard of and thought that it was an interesting watch. I like that this is combining a couple of Poe stories with a Stevenson one. It makes for some intriguing set pieces. There is a dark subject matter that gets explored, something I wouldn't necessarily expect for the era. I thought that Wagner is solid as our lead, Paulson is good as his counterpart, and the rest of the cast was solid for what was needed. Filmmaking was fine. I did have an issue that it ran too long and I lost interest for a stretch. Regardless of how this to be an above average movie, I would revisit this one to see what I might have missed now that I have seen this one as well. So my rating here for The Living Dead is going to be a 7 out of 10. Now I'm not going to do a spoiler section, as I don't think there's anything else I need to delve any deeper into, so let me go ahead and get you over to the trailer of my second featured review.
Do you have any idea what it's like to have no control over your entire life?
I do.
I've got an 8-year-old girl. School wants us to look into it.
Are you here to take me away?
I'm here to help.
It's a scratch on my face.
You can tell me.
I didn't get it from a fall.
We gotta do something about this.
I see things that people aren't supposed to see.
How often do you see them?
All the time.
Is it true you can see ghosts?
You have to go.
You have these walls around you. No windows, no door.
I'm so sorry.
Don't pretend like you don't feel anything.
There's no one else who can help us.
I don't know if I can.
Who would you leave me to?
I'm not afraid of you! Just give me back my daughter!
And for my second featured review here on this episode is going to be They Live in the Gray. This is from 2022. This was co-written and co-directed between Abel Vang and Burley Vang. This stars Michelle Krusiak, Ken Kirby, and Madeline Grace, while also featuring J.R. Cassia, Ellen Rowe, Mercedes Manning, Willie S. Hosa, Audrey Moore, Jaden Tran, Cammy Storm, Richard Steinmetz, Ian Stanley, Bunny Levine, Patrick Hume, Naomi Matsuda, Ray Julian Torres, Crystal Martin, and Bernard Bullen. This is a horror thriller film that is from the United States. It is currently sitting on a 5.0 on IMDb and a 2.7 on Letterboxd, with the synopsis being, Claire, while investigating a child abuse case, discovers the family is being tormented by a supernatural entity. So this is a movie that went on my radar as one of the earlier 2022 films. I knew this one went to Shudder, and I didn't know a whole lot about it aside from that. I did know that it featured an Asian star, and that would be Krusiak. And it made me wonder if we would get lore from a different country or something like that. Unfortunately, that's not necessarily the case. But before I get into the movie itself and all of that good stuff, let me go over to some featured notes here with our key people. And I'll start with our directors. And the first one will be Abel Vang. They directed 3 works so far. 2 are in horror. This is the only one that I've seen. The other one was Bedeviled from 2016. I don't think I've ever heard of this one. Now, as a writer, they have the same 2 in genre. And that's the only 2 that they've written. Now, their co-director, Burley Vang, has 3 movies in this role as well as a writer, so they really just have done everything together. Moving to our cast, I'll start with Krusiak. She has 30 credits. I've seen 5. Out of horror, I've seen her in What Happens in Vegas. In genre, she also has 5. I've seen Cursed, The Invitation, Bone Box, and now this. The only one that I haven't is from 2016 called The Unbidened. I also have never heard of this movie. Now, her co-star of Kirby has 10 that he's been in. I've seen 2. Out of horror, I've seen him in She's the Man. His first in horror was from 2020 with Browse. I've not heard of that one, so this is the only one that I've seen from him in genre. Then I'll look at our other star here of Grace. She's been in 4 movies. In horror, she's been in 2, and I've seen both. Her first was Don't Breathe 2, where she stars as the little girl in that one. So when we get into this movie here, we have a bleak start. We're in a house that looks lived in. We hear odd sounds and it shifts over to someone trying to kill themselves. The rope snaps, dropping them to the ground. It then shifts over to our lead of Claire, who is portrayed by Krusiak. She is married to Peter, portrayed by Kirby, but they're estranged. Through different things, we learn that they had a son by the name of Lucas, portrayed by Tran, and he has passed away and they haven't gotten through it. I'll point out here that Claire is a social worker with Child Protective Services and Peter is a police officer. We then shift over to Claire while she's in court. The judge is ruling that a mother will no longer have custody of her child and it's being taken away, and Claire tries to sway the decision. The only way that this can happen, though, is if she recants her statements. She cannot do this, though, and we see things are a bit tense with her boss due to what she did there. What I want to interject is that Claire is different. She is clairvoyant and sees ghosts. She didn't reveal this to her husband, so he has no idea. It makes life much more difficult. There's a spooky scene with her and Steve, portrayed by Ian Stanley. Now, this person is a ghost that she meets in her dining room. This is just the start of things. The crux of this movie is that Claire is assigned to the case with Sophie Lang, who is portrayed by Grace. She has a cut on her cheek and bruises when we first meet with her, and this includes when Claire does as well. Sophie lives with her father, portrayed by Giles, portrayed by Cassia, and her mother of Audrey, portrayed by Roe. Through an interview with the girl, Sophie reveals that her stories of where her injuries came from are lies. It isn't from her parents, though, either. The house is haunted and a ghost is doing them. Claire experiences it as well. This complicates things with her job, as she doesn't want to take this case, so she gives it up. When Sophie's principal contacts CPS again, Claire tries to do what she can to help this family and keep them together, as well as save them from this supernatural entity. Her own life with it will also get in the way, and dark secrets are revealed. So that's where I'm going to leave my recap, as well as fleshing out our key characters. Where I want to start is that I was on board in the beginning for where this movie was going. It hooked me with the attempted suicide and seeing the awkward interaction between Claire and Peter, then seeing her in court and the first interaction with the ghost. I wasn't sure who Steve was, but it does well in establishing that. I give credit to this movie. It jumped right in and got my attention and then got us to the main problem we are exploring. It's an interesting dilemma for sure. I do feel that I need to shift over to the issue that I had here, though. This movie is too long to the point where I lost interest. I had to rewind a couple scenes to make sure I didn't miss anything as my mind was wandering. This runs over 2 hours and doesn't need to be. I honestly think there is 15 to 30 minutes that could be trimmed to make this run tighter. Even with removing that, I think you still have enough to establish the Yang family, the Langs, and ramp up the tension. With how it is, the movie just came up to be boring, unfortunately. With that taken care of, I do want to go over to the implications here. Now, for a brief time, I have collaborated with social workers in my job. Not necessarily like we get here, but similar. This is a job that is rewarding when good things happen, but draining when you have to do tough things. I like that it's set up that Claire has a good heart. Losing her child makes her want to help other mothers. There is this idea, though, of doing your job. She goes over and above to help the Lang family. This raises the stakes, and it worked for me. It also requires Claire to come to terms with her loss in the process. Despite all of what they did, there is this reveal at the end that didn't necessarily need to be there. It felt like the movie needed it to be edgier and do something to shock us. I can understand the route taken by the character, though. So the last thing I'll go over here with the story would be that Claire and her loss. Throughout the movie, we see Peter trying to reconcile with her. It made me think that he did something, but it turns out she is harboring the blame. She is pushing him away in the process. Neither are to blame, and I won't go farther than that, though. We need to see how both handle this in different ways, and I think that's a good thing there. We see that he still cares, and I think she does as well. She just can't forgive herself. I've not experienced what they have, so I can't connect. I've been in relationships that have fallen apart, though, and I see that they still can make it work, which invests me. So then I'll go over to the acting here, and I thought that Krusiak does a good job as Claire. She fit the role, and I believe her performance. I also connect with her in seeing how broken she is, as I've also felt with depression in the past. There is this unbearable weight on her shoulders, and it isn't ready to be removed from her yet, and she needs to work through things. We see that as the movie goes on. Kirby is good as her husband. I feel bad for him having been in a similar spot as him where he stands, and that he still loves her. She doesn't know how she feels, and that's a tough spot to be in. Grace is solid as a daughter. I like Cassia and Roe as the parents. Mercedes, Manning, Stanley, and the rest of the ghosts are good. And I'll be honest, there are some creepy things with them that we get. That worked for me. Overall, I'd say the acting was solid across the board. So then to end out this, before I go over to just a bit of trivia, I'll go over the filmmaking aspects. I think the cinematography is solid here. The movie is shot well. We do get some good things with camera angles, and I like how the scenes will change with Claire dealing with ghosts. That adds an interesting element for me. I would say that the effects were fine. The practical ones that we get were good to the point where at least one of them made me cringe. I give credit there. There is some CGI that wasn't so good, unfortunately. That hurt it slightly, but we don't get a lot of it, so I am forgiving. Other than that, I'd say the soundtrack works. It didn't necessarily stand out, but I do think they do some good things with sound design that I will give credit to here as well. So on for the trivia, this went under the production by the name of The Uncanny. Yeah, a lot of it there for you. But to close this out here, this movie does some interesting things. We have some things that we've seen before and mixing haunting with social work. It makes for a predicament that adds tension. I'd say the acting is solid, as were the filmmaking aspects, while the cinematography and effects were good. The title also has interesting concept in the ghosts that are living in limbo while Claire is with her life. There are some CGI moments that didn't work for me. This does run too long as well. I think that the 15 to 30 minutes could be trimmed to make this run tighter. With how it stands, I still enjoyed the movie and what it did. It's just over average for me, though. Tweaks of things, and this could have had something much better here, in my opinion. So my rating here for They Live in the Gray is going to be a 6 out of 10. Not going to do a spoiler section. I don't think that's something I really need to necessarily do here. So let me get you over to one last break before I close out the show.
Journey with a Cinephile.
I would like to welcome you back. And then just to close everything out here, if you'd like to send me an email with any sort of feedback or anything that you'd like to have read on the show, you can send me that email at journeywithacinephile@gmail.com. If there's anything that you send me you don't want to write on the show, just let me know in that email. If you'd like to read any of the reviews from anything on this episode or any of the past episodes, that's horrorreview.webnode.com. If you'd like to become friends with me on Facebook, I'm David Michigan Garrett Jr. On Twitter, I'm Buckeye from Mish. Letterboxd, I'm David OSU. And over there, I'll be posting all of the reviews of anything that I'm watching that is horror or non-horror alike. If you'd like to follow my Instagram page, that's DavidOSU87. If you'd like to follow the Journey with a Cinephile Instagram, that's Journey with a Cinephile, all one word. What I will be posting over there is, on both of them, the movie posters of anything that I am reviewing. And if you follow my personal one, every now and then you might see some personal pictures if I ever post any, because I tend to forget while I'm out and about. And just to make it easier on you, I'll have all of those links in the show notes. And then the last thing I'd ask you to do is that whatever podcatching device you're listening to me on, if you could go ahead and hit subscribe so you never miss a new episode, that would be greatly appreciated. Also, if you're able to rate and review just so I can figure out what I'm doing that you like and what I'm doing that you don't like, as well as to get out to more listeners out there as well. And for my next episode, I believe that is going to be another Trek to the Twos. I mean, I know that it's going to be that, but what I believe the two movies are going to be is, I've already watched Strangers of the Evening. I still need to do my review and everything like that, but that'll be the movie from 1932. And then I'm going to be pairing it up, I believe, with Mad God. This is from Phil Tippett that is at the Gateway Film Center. It might also be on Shudder now. Not sure about that, but I'm going to try to watch that. If not, I will ad-lib in another movie to make sure that I get in, you know, a movie from 2022. Outside of that, I'll continue to watch more movies for the Summer Challenge series as my mini reviews. Try to watch as many of those as I can to get as much content on here for you as that. There's not much else that I need to kind of get you up to speed with here. So then what I will say in closing is, once again, thank you so much for listening. And I hope that whatever you do today, I hope you're safe and doing it and have a great time out there. This is your tour guide of David Garrett Jr. I want to thank you for coming on this journey with me, and I am signing off.
It had been a wonderful evening. And what I needed now to give it the perfect ending.